Hello, welcome back to this very, very special study of the question, when did or will the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9, 24 and following come to an end? As I suggested to you in video number one, this is an absolutely critical doctrine, question, and issue. Because you see, if in fact it is true that Daniel chapter 9 is messianic in its import, in its content, and in its predictions, then it is in fact a prophecy of the resurrection. That is why I wrote one of my books years ago, 70 weeks are determined for the resurrection. Because the constituent elements that are found in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 24, six constituent elements, are in fact, most of them, directly related to the resurrection. Thus, if we can determine when the 70 weeks were supposed to end, or when they are supposed to end, then we can determine by that the time of the resurrection. Now, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure. Our dispensational friends go to Daniel chapter 9, and they tell us, okay, the 70 weeks brings us right down to the baptism of Jesus. Jesus came to establish the kingdom. That's admitted. That is taught. However, according to the dispensational paradigm, even though Jesus offered the kingdom to the Jews, they rejected it. And as a direct consequence of that, God withdrew the kingdom offer. He postponed the prophetic countdown. He divorced the 70 weeks from the 69 and has now postponed the 70-week countdown for 2,000 years until such a time as he raptures the church off of the earth and begins to deal once again with Israel. And that's where you have the man of sin, the temple in Jerusalem, the breaking of the peace treaty between Israel and the man of sin, the great tribulation, etc., etc. Well, you see, in order to do that, you have to be able to prove that there is a gap of 2,000 years in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9. As we proceed in this study, I'm going to demonstrate to you categorically, definitively, and I think irrefutably, there is absolutely no justification for a 2,000-year gap between the 69th and the 70th week. Thus, the contention of dispensationalism that the 70 weeks will end at some point of time in our future is false. Secondly, it is very common in the amillennial and the postmillennial world to say that the 70th week of Daniel chapter 9 ended either number one at the cross or number two, more commonly and popularly, the view that the 70 weeks ended somewhere around 34 or 35 A.D. This is the view of many prominent amillennialists. It is the view also of postmillennialist Kenneth Gentry and Gary DeMar. I do not believe that any of those views are tenable. I do not believe they are defensible. I believe that we are directed by the direct evidence of Scripture with an overwhelming amount of evidence that the 70 weeks ended in A.D. 70. Now, what happens with those who believe that the 70 weeks ended in 34, 35, or even at the cross, they completely divorce the constituent elements of verse 24 from the resurrection. They completely divorce it from the eschatological consummation. They put the entirety of their focus on the initiation of the kingdom, for instance, at Pentecost, and then they jump forward to the stoning of Stephen, and they say, well, you see, it is at that point that God consummated the 70 weeks. Well, it's kind of funny. It's kind of interesting, and it's very significant, that in the New Testament, well after the stoning of Stephen, we find direct allusions to the impending yet future to the New Testament writers, and yet imminent fulfillment of the constituent elements of Daniel 9:24. Why is it that not one New Testament writer ever refers back to the stoning of Stephen as a pivotal part of the 70-week countdown? Why is it that not one single New Testament writer ever refers back to the stoning of Stephen as the end? Why is it that the New Testament writers constantly posit the fulfillment of several of the constituent elements of Daniel 9:24 as yet future to them, if they believed that all of the constituent elements were fulfilled either at the cross or in AD 34 and 35? You see, these are major, major important questions that, by the way, I have never seen, read, or heard a single advocate of the end of the 70 weeks being at the cross or in AD 34 and 35 offer any kind of an explanation for. Not one. Yet these are critical, critical elements. And we will get to them as we proceed in this study. For now, I want to spend the rest of my time today examining the correlation between Daniel 9, 24 to 27, and Daniel chapter 2. Now, among conservative scholars, among dispensationalists, among amillennialists, and among even postmillennialists, it's agreed that Daniel 9 predicted the coming. Oh, pardon me. Good coffee this morning. That Daniel 9 predicted the establishment of the kingdom. Okay. On that basis, on that admission, here's what we have. In Daniel chapter 9, we have a prediction of the coming of the kingdom. And by the way, we have the terminus of the destruction of Jerusalem found within that prophecy, i.e., 70 weeks are determined on your people and on your city. Now, we're going to have a whole lot more to say about that language as we proceed. But the point of fact is, in the bringing in of everlasting righteousness, in the anointing of the Most Holy, in the sealing up vision and prophecy, in those constituent elements, we have, by virtue of unanimous consent among conservative scholars, a prediction of the establishment of the kingdom. Okay, thus, when we go to Daniel chapter 2, and we see there the prediction of the establishment of a kingdom, number one, not made with hands, number two, that shall never, ever pass away, and number three, the establishment of that kingdom would be in the days of the fourth empire, the fourth kingdom that is delineated in Daniel chapter 2, then that means that we have Daniel chapter 2 predicting the establishment of the kingdom, the everlasting kingdom, and we have Daniel chapter 9 predicting the establishment of the kingdom, predicting the establishment of the everlasting kingdom. In other words, 70 weeks are determined to bring in everlasting righteousness. So these passages are clearly, clearly parallel. But I want this morning, and I'm filming, about 6 o'clock. I want now to examine, at least briefly, maybe a little more than briefly, the suggestion that Daniel chapter 9 and Daniel chapter 2 are not, in fact, messianic. This is a position now held by some former preterists, and it is a position held by many critical scholars. John Collins, for instance, believes that Daniel 2 and Daniel 9 applied to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C. Now, let me observe, I believe that Antiochus Epiphanes and the things that he did were typological of the events of the last days. However, these prophecies, Daniel chapter 2 specifically, emphatically tells us that it was a prediction for and to be fulfilled in the last days. Now, folks, that's critical. Do you realize that not one Old Testament prophet ever said they were living in the last days? Do you realize that in the book of Daniel, specifically Daniel chapter 8, which is a very clear prophecy of Antiochus Epiphanes, do you realize that not one of those texts say that it referred or that posit that prediction in the last days? And somebody may jump up and say, well, wait a minute now, Preston. It talks about the kingdoms that would spring out of Alexander the Great, and it says it shall come to pass in the last days of their kingdom. Well, that's right. This delineates, this emphatically defines the term the last days in this text as the last days of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. It's not the eschatological last days. And so we must be very, very careful in our hermeneutic and in our exegesis. So I want to examine now Daniel chapter 2. You're probably familiar with the story, I hope you are, of how Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in the night. He saw an incredible beast, may I use that term, an incredible figure, head of gold, breastplate of silver, and on down to iron and clay. And he was troubled. He did not understand what that vision was. Now, it was a dream, but it was also a vision given to him by God. So, here is Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the vast, great, and marvelous Babylonian Empire that had destroyed the Judean kingdom earlier. Daniel was one of those taken captives in that destruction, Daniel and his partners, along with the inhabitants of Judea and Jerusalem. Well, Nebuchadnezzar called his wise men and he said, you tell me, number one, what my dream was, and number two, you tell me the interpretation of it. If you can't tell me what my dream was and its interpretation, guess what? I'm just going to kill every one of you. Well, needless to say, they were a little bit upset about that, understandably so. And they said, well, how are we supposed to give you the interpretation if we don't know what the vision was? And he said, that's the whole point. You're supposed to be dream interpreters. You're supposed to be wise men. You're supposed to be magi. You're supposed to know what my dream was. So will you either tell me the dream and its interpretation or you're going to die? Well, so Daniel was called by Arioch, who went to the king and said, O king, there's another wise man, and his name is Daniel from the Judean captivity. I believe you ought to give him a chance. This is Daniel chapter 2, 24 and following. And so Daniel spent some time in prayer, and he came before the king, and he said, O king, there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. And in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, it is the Hemeron Eschaton, in the last days. This is the same identical term as found in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2 and following, in which in the last days the God of heaven would set up the Messianic temple, understood virtually universally among conservative commentators to refer to the eschatological last days. Joel chapter 2, 28 and following, it shall come to pass in the last days, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Eschaton ton hemeron. The eschatological last days. That's the exact Greek term used here in the Septuagint. And so, we have here, unless it can be proven absolutely definitively, that Daniel is using the term the last days in a totally separate, distinct, non-messianic way from the text that used that term in a strictly messianic term, then we are being told that this vision of Daniel chapter 2 is messianic in its import. Well, that alone blows out of the water the concept that this prophecy is about Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C. Jesus did not come in the 2nd century B.C. And by the way, the rest of the vision of Daniel chapter 2 did not and was not fulfilled in the 2nd century B.C. Now, I want you to notice that Daniel begins giving the interpretation to the king. Now, remember, he is giving the interpretation of the vision. He told him what the vision was. Now he's going to interpret it. And he said, verse 31, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, this great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Now I want to stop right here and I want to make mention of something. I want you to notice that we have here what I call representative judgment. I want you to notice that it says a stone was cut out without hands and it struck the image, now watch, on its feet and clay. And it broke them in pieces. Okay? That's the final kingdom. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all crushed together. Wait a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Chronologically, you got the Babylonians, which Daniel identifies as Nebuchadnezzar is the head of that kingdom. The Medes and the Persians, separate total kingdom that destroyed the Babylonians, Daniel chapter 5. Then you have the Greeks who destroyed the Persians. Then you have the Romans who destroyed the Greeks. All of those happened at, quote, separate times. But wait a minute. According to the text, this stone cut out without hands destroyed them all together. You see, when Rome destroyed Greece, and Greece had destroyed Medes and the Persians, and the Medes and the Persians had destroyed Babylon, to destroy Rome was to destroy all of them. Representative judgment. It's a good, solid Hebraic way of thinking. And it's a concept that lots and lots and lots of Bible students need to be familiar with. Okay? So, notice now, once again, verse 35. There was a stone cut out without hands. We're going to get back to that here in just a moment. Now, we are very often told, and in the Antiochus Epiphanes view of Daniel chapter 9, we are told that the four kingdoms that would appear afterwards were the successors of Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian Empire. Well, I'm sorry, that won't work. Daniel identified Nebuchadnezzar as the king over the kingdom, and then he specifically identified another kingdom, not just a king, okay, not just a king belonging to the Babylonians, because you see, it's of a different nature. It's of a lesser quality, and so the Antiochian view says, well, yeah, the successor to Nebuchadnezzar wasn't as great as he was. No, this is a different kingdom. It's the, in the Antiochian view, it's the same kingdom, just different kings. I'm sorry, that violates the text that says, you're the kingdom of Babylon, there's another kingdom coming after you, then another kingdom, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. That kingdom will break in pieces. Now watch this. Once again, that kingdom, and the two words, that kingdom, are in ellipticals, italics, which means they're not technically in the text, but that's the meaning of it. They're elliptical. That fourth empire will crush and destroy all the previous kingdoms. Well, guess what? There was no fourth king that destroyed Babylon or Nebuchadnezzar and his successors until the fourth one. You see, it just simply doesn't work, ladies and gentlemen. But I want to continue. Now, notice verse 41. Whereas you saw the feet and the toes, watch this carefully, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Well, in the days of these kings, you see, now he's talking about the fourth kingdom that has many kings. Fourth kingdom, many kings. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Let's be very, very clear on this point. A couple of points. Point number one. He refers to the clay as the potter's clay that would be mixed with the iron in the days of that fourth kingdom. It is not simply coincidental that in Isaiah, which was written well before Daniel, and thus would serve as part of his theological matrix of understanding, in Isaiah chapter 64, the Lord spoke of Israel, and he said to them, I am the potter, you are the clay. Do you catch the power of that? Now again, keep in mind, Isaiah was written well before Daniel. And thus, in Israel's understanding, in Daniel's understanding, Yahweh was the potter, Israel was the clay. Thus, when it says you're going to have potter's clay mixed with iron, this is essentially pretty clear terminology saying that Israel would exist in this fourth empire and mix with it, but it would be inferior to the iron. Well, we know Israel was inferior. So that's the first point. Israel is the potter's clay. The second point is this repeat of the promise. In the days of these kings, that's the fourth kingdom, not the fourth king, the fourth kingdom. The God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Now, let me ask you a question. And this is critical. If Daniel chapter 2 is talking about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, what kingdom, what everlasting kingdom, what everlasting kingdom that will never be destroyed, what everlasting kingdom that shall never be destroyed, that was cut out without hands, not made with hands, what kingdom was established in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes? Ladies and gentlemen, there was no everlasting kingdom established in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. there was no everlasting kingdom not made with hands, established in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. There was no everlasting kingdom not made with hands that shall never pass away, that crushed and destroyed all these other kingdoms or overcame them in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, you know, you might argue that, well, you have the Maccabees and they were successful against Antiochus Epiphanes and his armies. Well, that's true, but the Maccabees did not establish a kingdom, an everlasting kingdom, and a kingdom not made with hands. For you see, the truth is that the kingdom of Israel, the potter's clay, was a kingdom made with hands. It was an earthly kingdom. Now, here's what you need to understand, and boy, oh boy, oh boy, this is so critical. And that is, throughout the New Testament, echoing, and scholars recognize this, okay? Conservative scholars have recognized this for century upon century upon century. Throughout the New Testament, we are given reference, for instance, and we're even given this in Isaiah chapter 66. Isaiah chapter 66, the prophet said, Yahweh spoke through him and said, "Heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool." Pardon me. "Where is the house that you will build me?" Now watch this. In Acts 6 and 7, Stephen standing in the temple, that marvelous, beautiful temple made with hands, said, "God does not dwell in temples made with hands." You see, this terminology, by the way, many scholars have pointed out that this terminology of "not made with hands" absolutely refers to the spiritual work of Christ. In Hebrews chapter 8, after talking about Christ and His priesthood, Christ in the temple and the tabernacle, etc., etc., the writer says, "Now this is the sum of that which we have been saying. We have such a high priest who ascended into the heavens as to sit down at the majesty of the throne on high. He has become the minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle that was not made or pitched by man, but by God." You see the idea? In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 11, I'm going to turn there because you really, really, really got to catch the power of this particular verse. Christ has become a high priest of the good things about to come, as many, many translations say, with the greater, more perfect tabernacle not made with hands. That is, not of this creation. Boy, that last little phrase, "not of this creation," oh, that's powerful. Do you get the point here? In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5, Peter was writing to the saints, saying to them, "You therefore are living stones, being built up a spiritual house to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." What kind of a house, temple, were they building? The temple of God, not made with hands. Now listen, what Judas Maccabeus, what John Hyrcanus, what the entire tribe of the Maccabees were trying to do, were to reestablish the kingdom made with hands. Since the kingdom that they were seeking to restore, not to establish, was the kingdom made with hands, was a kingdom defended, promoted, expanded by the sword, they were not seeking to establish the very kingdom that Daniel was predicting. That means that the Antiochian proposal for understanding Daniel chapter 2 is simply not biblical. So, since the New Testament writers interpret that kingdom not made with hands in a spiritual sense, a contrast between the Old Covenant kingdom, the Old Covenant world, versus the New Covenant kingdom, the New Covenant world of Christ, and again, appealing directly to Daniel chapter 2, then we are on absolutely firm ground in saying that Daniel chapter 2 is in fact messianic. And here's what that means. That means that since Daniel 2 and Daniel 9 are parallel in teaching the coming of the kingdom. Okay? Daniel chapter 2, in the days of the fourth kingdom. Now, you got to catch the power of this. If it is true that the kingdom that would never pass away, if it is true that the kingdom not made with hands is a reference to the church, and the church was established in the days of Rome, then that means that the fourth kingdom of Daniel chapter 2 was Rome. See, it's that easy. It's that irrefutable. So, again, here's what we have. We have Daniel chapter 2. In the days of Rome, the God of heaven would set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and it shall crush, overcome all kingdoms. It's a kingdom not made with hands. Well, Daniel chapter 9 predicted that 70 weeks were determined to establish the kingdom. And that 70-week countdown brings us where? To the days of Rome, by all conservative scholars' consent. Now, it's really interesting, and real quick digression here. I was reading an article just this morning as I was researching and developing this lesson, of a dispensational article on the internet, and the writer said, although the text says that there are four kingdoms that were going to come, we know that there are actually five. No, we don't. Not if we're going to honor what the text says. And so this writer went ahead to say, if we read the text carefully, we can see that the toes of iron and clay refer to a revived Roman Empire. No, we cannot see that. There is not a word, there is not a clue, there is not a hint, there is not a suggestion of a revived Roman Empire in Daniel chapter 2. That entire premise is based, ladies and gentlemen, upon the idea that Daniel chapter 9 gave the 70 weeks, Jesus came right at the right time, but the Jews rejected it, therefore God postponed the kingdom. And he slipped in an interregnum period of 2,000 years into Daniel chapter 2 between the iron and the clay, and slipped it forward 2,000 years, just as he slipped a 2,000-year gap between the 69th and the 70th week. I'm sorry, that doesn't work, because 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your city. And after the 69th week and in the midst of the week, Messiah will be cut off. Messiah will be cut off when? After the 69th week, in the midst of the week. You see, the 70th week kept on counting. And the end of the 70-week countdown is the destruction of Jerusalem. The people of the prince who shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary and the end thereof. The end of what? Well, the people of the city for whom 70 weeks were determined. You see, Daniel 9, 26 and 27 is not talking about a termination of the 70 weeks and then the destruction of Jerusalem after the termination of the 70 weeks. No, 70 weeks are determined on your people and on your city. And that determination included the fate of the city. That determination included the destruction of the city. And I'll get to it much later, but let me make this final point. Daniel was not told 70 weeks are determined for a prophecy to be given to determine the fate of the city. No, that's what Gentry and DeMar, Kim Riddlebarger and others say. They say, well, Daniel is saying that 70 weeks are determined for Jesus to come and determine the fate of the city. The fate of the city lies outside of the 70 weeks, but Jesus would determine the fate of the city within the 70 weeks. Sorry, folks, it won't work. The fate of the city was determined right there in Daniel 9. 70 weeks are determined for the people in the city. The people of the prince who shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. If that's not determining the fate of the city right there in Daniel 9, I don't know what it is. Therefore, there's no need for a later determination to find out what's going to happen. It was already determined right there in Daniel chapter 9, 26 and 27. Okay, thank you so much for watching this video. I think you can see that Daniel 2 and Daniel chapter 9 are parallel in their prophecies. They are both messianic. They both refer to the time of the Roman Empire. That means that Daniel 9 and its 70 weeks had to be fulfilled no later than the days of the Roman Empire. And again, there's no hint, no clue, no suggestion of a revived Roman Empire anywhere in the Bible. That's a theological contrivance, a theological invention that has no merit whatsoever. So, Daniel 2, fulfilled in the days of Rome. Daniel 9, predictive of the days of Rome. The New Testament was written in the days of the Roman Empire, and the New Testament writers said over and over and over, the time is fulfilled. The kingdom has drawn near. And they tell us the judgment, the coming of the Lord, and the resurrection was at hand 2,000 years ago. It's all the time I've got left for. In our next video, we're going to be examining Daniel chapter 7. Is it a prediction of Antiochus Epiphanes? Is it messianic? Or is it likewise parallel with Daniel chapter 9? And in fact and in truth, messianic and predictive of the establishment of the kingdom, the coming of the Lord in the first century. You won't want to miss that. I'll see you there.